It's about 8:05 on Wednesday morning. With us as part of the quorum today, Representative Grusendorf, Coring, Martin, myself, Hanley, Terrio, Kelly, and Navarro. The first bill I'd like to take up is House Bill 183. This was the carryover from the other day. Representative Martin had reworked his amendment to, I think, well, you can explain it.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't formally introduce this amendment the other day. It was just brought up for consideration. And the parties that you acknowledged the other day did work on this amendment. I deliberately stayed out of it. And it looks like it's acceptable. So I'd like to formally offer amendment number one pertaining to the Alaska Housing Authority coming under Alaska Statute 1885-55.
56. That's the amendment. By Martin, it should be on your desk. It's to House Bill 183, page 1, line 1, after an act.
This is the revised version?
Yes, ma'am.
That will be amendment number 1. We also have joining us Representative Foster and Brown and Mulder. We're on House Bill 183. There's amendments. Representative Martin is on his amendment number 1. This is the revised amendment to the other day. Discussion or any objection to amendment number 1?
I'd like to object just for the sake of conversation, discussion. Did we ever find out if there's other state agencies that have similar loopholes like we were talking about? Did they ever get back to us on that?
Senator Martin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The other agencies that were talked about, Alaska Railroad and ADA, it looked like that they would be better to be fitted into the bill that was introduced the other day pertaining to the Executive Budget Act. So we can't say we saw a specific incident that needs to be answered right away. The Executive Budget Act bill would be better for them.
Any other comments? Are there any objections then to amendment number 1? Hearing none, amendment number 1 is adopted. Any discussion on the bill as amended?
Any motion, sir?
Okay. I will do that. Okay, Mr. Speaker. Hi, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Yeah, good morning. You're looking so, Speaker.
Get that long hair.
That's right. I would move committee substitute for HB 183, House Finance Committee substitute, as amended, with accompanying fiscal notes from committee with individual recommendations.
Any objections? Hearing none, that has moved from committee.
You sound like you're dying.
And next, I'd like to move to HJR 5, which is the term limits resolution.
Mr. Gutenberg's request, can this be changed to voters and not the candidates? Term limit for residents.
Representative Terrio, did you have an amendment you wanted to offer on your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The amendment's been passed out. It's M.3, dated 2/21/95. Basically, through the discussion the other day, I realize that it's quite confusing and unnecessary with the changes the Judiciary Committee made to have the language in there that says that terms served through an appointment would or would not be counted in the different situations. Since the Judiciary Committee added the language that says that if you come up to the term limit of 12 years and you are partially through an elected term, that we would just let you serve out the remainder of that term. That pretty much captures everybody. I had made the difference or distinction before because I had wanted an automatic absolute cutoff at 12 years. And what I had done was try to limit the number of people that would be halfway through a term. Since, like I said, the Judiciary Committee adds that language letting you fill out the remainder of your term past the 12 years, then it's not necessary. And amending M.3 deletes that language, basically making it a lot cleaner, the wording a lot cleaner, I believe. So if you look on page 2, lines right after, on line 2, right after the word consider, we would delete that next sentence, which specifically talked about a person moving from one house to the other. And then on line 2, or page 2, line 6, instead of at the end of the sentence there, it says 4-year. We would just change that to new so that it would apply to both the House and the Senate. House is just 2-year. Then on line 7, at the very end there where it says 10, we change that to 11. So that basically you've served 11 terms, then you get elected to a Senate.
11 sessions?
Or yeah, 10 sessions, that's right. Then you would, and if you got elected to a Senate term, then you'd be able to serve out that new term. If you got elected to a House term, you'd be able to serve it out. So it just makes it generic, so it applies to both the House and the Senate. You can finish your term. And the last change there, page 2, line 8, is the same. We're just taking out the word Senate and putting new so that it applies both to the House and the Senate.
Basically, it would read, as Representative Martin said, it would make it simpler to understand, I think. At least there's less questions about does an appointment count. You've essentially eliminated all the appointments. If you're appointed, you serve part of a term, that session, that counts as a session, just as if you'd been elected to that session. So not as many questions. Any questions about the amendment? Did you move the amendment, Representative?
Mr. Chairman, I moved the amendment.
Any objections to amendment number 1?
Object. I don't know if this is appropriate, but the amendment that I have would not fit well with that amendment. Is it proper to discuss my amendment at this time and the fact that it wouldn't fit with the amendments that he's made?
Not really, but we can make it. We have the amendment before us, it's been moved. Representative Brown?
Well, it seems like Representative Terrio is just perfecting his concept, and that if Representative Kelly's amendment would be affected by that, we could perfect his too. I mean, if we...
Right. We can go back.
I mean, we could still consider his concept. We could go back and clean this up.
Exactly. We could make it conform if it needs to, and based on what this amendment would do.
That's fine. I withdraw the objection.
Hearing no objection, then Amendment Number 1 has been adopted. Amendment Number 2, Representative Kelly, we'll go to yours. We'll call Amendment Number 2, and Representative Brown will call yours Number 3, if that's all right. Number 3. So, Representative Kelly, if you'd like to go ahead and explain your...
Mr. Chairman, I don't
have
that.
I have one.
It wasn't in your packet. It was sit. It was next. There was a set next to your packets.
Right.
On the table, actually.
Put it on the top of the agenda.
You gave me one. That's fine.
Do you have one, Representative
Nolan? I have one.
Yes. My amendment would put a 16-year term limit for the legislature in general, and no more than 8 regular sessions in a single body, without taking a term, session break. In other words, 8 years in the House or Senate, and then a 2-year break, and then 8 years in whatever other body there is. With a 16-year term limit for the legislature in general, regardless of what combination that you had in either body. One thing this, I believe, makes it a little simpler. In the worst-case scenario, the bill as it is could give us 15 years. It could give a representative or a senator 15 years in the worst-case scenario. The worst-case scenario in this is 16 years. Because no matter how you work the math, whether a combination of House or Senate, if it ends up 16 years, you can fill out a term. Essentially, that's it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelly's right that under mine, the longest in any scenario that a person could serve would be 15 years, because they could get, on the 11th year, they could get elected to a Senate term. and have 4 years to serve. Now, that's under the particular circumstances where a person gets appointed shortly after a senator is seated, has to fill out the remainder of his term. So it would be unusual that a person would actually go 15 years. I think, though, the worst-case scenario under this amendment would be that there would be absolutely no term limit, because a person could go from house to house and never be limited. If you look at the language, it says you can't serve more than 8 years in that same house. Thereafter, the person may not again serve in that house as a result of an election. So I serve 10 years in the House, or 8 years in the House. I run for the Senate, and then after this, I serve 4 years in the Senate, I move back to the House. I could make an arrangement with the senator whose district corresponds with mine and just move back and forth, and there'd be no term limits for either of us ever kick in. And so I think basically this just means that there's no term limits. Or if I'm in a situation where, say I serve in a House district with a senator who's got less time in office than I do, once I get to 8 years, I have to either take on a popular senator, maybe somebody that I even support, or my time is done at 8 years. So it's not 16 years. It's 8 years, perhaps, or there's no limit, depending on how you worked it. And the example that I brought up, although this has happened for other reasons, is that now Senator Hoffman has moved back and forth from body to body for one reason or another. And so it does happen that people move back and forth. And in that case, there would be no term limit.
Representative Bruce Miller?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is not my question, but responding to remarks across the way there that, should a House member and a Senate member come up with such an agreement, who is the ultimate judge of that, whether or not it's going to be carried through? But my question really is, when you were talking, I guess this is to Kelly here, on line 7 it says at least 2 consecutive full regular sessions. Now, sessions are not terms, right? There's a distinction there. You're talking about the session itself. The life of the legislative body is 2 years, and I just want to make sure that sessions and terms are not confused, because then you'd have a problem where, if it was misconstrued to be terms, a person who is sitting out files for an election and then actually is elected, but the term has not ended for the other person, but thus it's not. But Representative Kelly, that's your intention, that when you say sessions, you're talking about the regular session days. That's what you're talking about.
Mr. Chairman, I think we discussed that when we were discussing Representative Terrio's original bill, and the sessions was defined as essentially two years. One year, yeah.
One.
But a regular session was 1 year, and two full sessions was...
No, I think actually it's Representative. Well, my understanding is that in Representative Terrio's original bill, it talks about regular sessions, and those are the sessions, the 120-day or 121-day regular session.
That's what I was referring to.
So it's a regular session. It doesn't take into account special sessions or.
No. Right, and Mr. Chairman, that language was put in to clarify that special sessions, additions to the regular session. Don't count. If we have a special session in the summer, that doesn't give you one more tick on the clock. It's only those 120-day regular
sessions. Well, thank you, sir. I just wanted to make sure that later on down the line we're not arguing over the terms of whether it's session terms, and you feel satisfied this is clear enough to do it.
I wanted to bring up a couple points. Just that I'm concerned that 16 years is too long. That's one of my concerns. I think that 12 years is a reasonable compromise. I think 16 years is too long. But my biggest concern is, the same one that Representative Terrio suggested, I believe the way it's written anyway, that there, a person who chose to jump back and forth would essentially have no term limits. They would be able to go back and forth, because it says they may not serve consecutively more than 8 regular sessions in the same house. So I believe, Representative
Barr. In addition to the language on page one line nine, which says you can't serve consecutively more than 16 regular sessions in a legislature, period.
Oh, I see.
Right,
okay.
That's what I was just...
Okay, so that argument... But my main concern is the equity between the House and the Senate, and I would suggest that half of the House members will never have the option, if they choose to go to their full 8 years, of running for the Senate, because we have Senate terms that run 4 years and are every other. So half of the legislature, whenever you get elected, you're going to get to the end of your 8 years, and you're done. You cannot even have that option to run for the other body, at least half of the people, if they run through, because your Senate seat isn't up then. And I think that inequity alone outweighs the concerns of the others. I like the other approach, which is 12 years. There's problems with that. You may have to end up running just one term for the Senate, but at least you have that option to stay in the House, and as other people pointed out, that you could potentially end up running against somebody that you didn't want to run against, and that would be a personal decision as to whether you ran. But the fact that just after 8 years, and it doesn't matter whether you made it 6 years or 10 years, at some point half the people would never have the option of even running for that Senate seat. So you've automatically limited half the people when they first get elected based on when they get elected. They have an absolute 8-year limit and have to sit out for 2 years. The other half of the House has a potential 8-year limit, but they could also run and have the option of running beyond that. And, of course, the Senate would not have that particular problem because the House seat is always open. So, you know, one quarter of the people running at all times is, you know, you've automatically eliminated somebody. I think it treats people differently just based on when they get elected, and that concerns me with this specific approach. Representative Kelly?
Once again, you're approaching it from what's fair to the politician, and I think you said that, yes, there is that one argument that you would only be able to serve 4 years under the current bill. If you were to swap over the Senate, you would only be able to serve 4 years. That's more about what's fair to the district, and I think that's how we have to approach this argument. It really doesn't matter what's fair to us, because apparently that people aren't concerned. They want term limits. That's fine. But we don't want to give them term limits in such a way that it diminishes their representative's ability to represent them. And in this situation, with that 12-year limit after, you know, if you have 8 years and then a swap over and have a 12-year limit, that's it. He's a lame duck. And Representative Terrio pointed out that, in fact, yes, there are two reorganizations of the Senate. But that's just the way the Senate does business. That's still one term. That person shows up, and he is not able to represent his district as well as the other people who have at least two. My amendment at least allows for a person who would swap over to the Senate to represent their district in a more of a long-term fashion, which is the purpose of the Senate anyway. That's why the Senate moves differently than we do. That's why they have longer terms than we do. And what we've done is we've taken that whole concept and we've gone, forget it. You're out of luck, district.
Well, Representative Kelly, I would just respond that I think that occurs no matter what. I think you are arguing for a longer term limit, and that you would argue that 16 years should be the time frame for the total term limit, because under your argument, no matter what year you put it, somebody's going to be shorted. Somebody in the House at the 6 year is going to have one term left in the House. That's unfair to the district if somebody thought they should have been able to serve 10 years. If you put it at, you know, the way it sits now, somebody might only be able to serve one term in the Senate. But at the second time that they serve in the Senate, they also, unfair to the district, because if the district was interested, what you're saying is the district is interested in having that person beyond the length of the term. And therefore, the second time, you can make the same argument that the second time around, that person then has a term limit, is lame duck. So my concern is that it is inequitable. I think it's more inequitable to the district this way, because the district has an absolute guarantee that their person, after 8 years in the House, is gone. That's an absolute, not just a choice, because that person's Senate seat isn't even up. So I think that's more unfair to the district, the way, whether it's 6 years in a row and 6 years in a row, or 8-8, or 12-12, that is, I think, more unfair to the district than even just having the option and putting everybody on equal footing with the 12 years.
How is it different than putting everybody on equal footing with the 16 years? I'm not sure how that... this scenario, my scenario, this amendment, it, because of the the difference in the term served, the 2 year versus the 4 years in the House and the Senate, when we lump them both together and say there's a 12 year limit out there, and I think, let's see where. If we have a 12 year limit out there, I guess what I'm saying is that if you have 8 years and then eight, somewhere along that 8 year period, no matter what combination it is, the person in this amendment number 2 is going to have to step out. And he can re-enter at any point, but he will have already had a term limit. You follow me? If he's, okay, if he serves eight sessions
in the House or the Senate.
He automatically has to step out. There's the term limit right there. He can jump back in. He can serve now 8 in the Senate. He's got to get out again. This scenario of the 12, if you combine them, the math doesn't work, and it ends up with that inequity that I spoke of, whereas with my bill, my amendment, it doesn't necessarily happen that way, just because of the math.
I guess what I hear you arguing is that a district, that the term limit should be, that there's a huge difference between the House and the Senate, and that they should be treated totally separately as two different bodies, and that representation by somebody in the House that ends at 8 years, that's okay, but that somebody that chose to, what I'm saying is I prefer the other approach, I guess, because I think it does allow for people to make the same decisions. There is a potential, there are all kinds of potentials, but I see service in the legislature, more than, there are political reasons and even potentially gains that you can make by serving in one body or the other over the other, but I think there's potential gains by staying in one longer as well. And I think that's preferable.
Mr. Chairman, actually,
I'll wait to speak on the entire bill rather than just the amendment.
The amendment, okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Representative
I think we all have in mind that, you know, you serve out your full 8 years in the House and then you serve out the full year 8 years in the Senate. But a person may serve just 2 in the House and then go to the Senate and serve out their 8 there. You know, there's a variety of things that trigger when you may consider moving from the House to the Senate. And you're right, you know, the automatic cutoff for 50% of the House, just because their Senate term happens not to be up when they reach the limit, I think is an inequity. And I really agree with you, too. I think that the public looks at service in the legislature as just that. It's not service in the House versus service in the Senate. And I think there's a lot more flexibility if you just count up years of service of when a person should choose to decide when the person has an opportunity to potentially make a move. And so I just would prefer the original concept.
Any other comments? Ready to take a vote? Did you move the amendment, Representative?
No, but I will. I move amendment number 2.
If we could take a roll call vote.
Representative Brown?
Yes.
Representative Grusendorf?
Yes.
Representative Kelly?
Yes.
Representative Cowery?
Yes.
Representative Martin?
No.
Representative Mulder?
Yes.
Representative Navarre?
No.
Representative Parnell?
No.
Representative Theriault?
No.
Representative Hanley?
No.
Representative Foster?
No.
5 yea, 6 nay.
Mr. Chairman, I wish to change my vote if it's possible, from yes to no. I know it doesn't affect the outcome of the vote, but just for the record.
Sure. Representative Coring's asked to change his vote. Yes or no? Okay, amendment number 1, or number 2 has failed. Amendment number 3, Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Amendment number 3 would replace the language on page 2 that deals with when the amendment becomes effective. And or how it would apply to terms or service prior to the passage of the amendment. And I'll just note for the record that we all have a potential conflict of interest being directly affected by the outcome on this bill. But my thought is that if we're going to do this, we ought to just do it and implement it in the near term in a time frame that it's meaningful, as opposed to starting at some point in the future and then everyone who's already been here for a long time start accumulating the amount of years necessary to trigger the term limits. So this proposal would be to just beginning in the year, I think it's 2000.
2001.
Upon the convening of the first regular session of the 22nd legislature and thereafter. And the reason that it's not feasible to start it earlier than that is because you would have people elect, you were going to vote in 96, there would also be people running for the Senate in 96, so when all those terms are served out, then it would begin and people would know in the filing date for that election whether they had already been past the limit or not. So anyway, that's the concept, is to start the whole thing forward in the year 2000, counting all previous service, as opposed to the proposal that's before us, which doesn't count any of the previous service, and the amendment then won't be effective for a long time. And I think considering the cynicism of the public and the reason that people feel term limits are a good idea, it would behoove us to go ahead and make the thing be effective in a reasonable time frame. So I'll move amendment number 3.
Okay. Representative Martin.
Thank you. I kind of like it. It's a partial retroactive, is what we're saying. Would you consider that? Because as I look at it now, Representative Brown, you have here to the 22nd legislature, which actually takes us up to the year 2002. And is that in your intent that your 8 years between now does count retroactive?
Everything before.
So you only got 4 left.
Well, I believe it's everything.
It's before. Everything.
It's not just the 8 years.
Oh, everything.
You just count everything. It just say beginning in the year 2000. If you've already served, what are we in? Which version
that's
of this?
Better yet.
12 consecutive regular sessions. You got to sit out in that election.
In other words, get rid of
it. So we would just start by acknowledging and counting everybody's previous service beginning in the year 2000, as opposed to starting over and letting us all reaccumulate that before the limit would be in effect.
Yeah. So, partial, I love it.
So you could serve up to the year 2000 before there would be any effect, whether or not it passed in 1996.
Not encouraging you.
If I live that long. Thank you, Kay, for your encouragement.
How many more years between now and 2000? 6 more.
Representative Terrio?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, this is one of those things. I actually had considered this and worked on an amendment that would have counted part of the years, say, from the 18th legislature forward. So, you know, all of my time would have been counted. Parts of other people's time would have been counted. I don't know how many votes this gains or loses, because we have to have 27. That's my only concern. I don't have a problem, because, as I said, my partial retroactivity would have taken in all my time, so I wasn't trying to cut myself a deal or anything, but I just wonder if this severely changes the chances of anything passing, and certainly it could be stripped out on the House floor, too, if there was a real concern.
I would have. At this point, I would object, just because I'm going to make a political decision, and I don't think it'll pass if it has this in it, particularly in, maybe not on our side, but somewhere else. And I think it's important to get it implemented, and I would hate to have have it die because of that. So mine is strictly a political decision, not to have it retroactive.
Vote for it.
Representative Martin.
Mr. Chairman, everything we do is a political decision. The good thing about this here is that we know last year and the 2 years before, when we had a complete retroactive, it was not acceptable by the majority of the legislatures in office. This one here is a real challenge, since it's partial. And that's what the people want. This is what we've seen by public initiatives. Most Southern people, California is a great example, gave them no clause to go forward. It was retroactive. I can't believe it caught half the legislators off guard, didn't know it was retroactive when they had a chance to do something. But anyway, people initiative have always counted retroactive. the legislators' initiative have always done part of it or no time already in office to make the difference. This is a good compromise, just like Representative Terrio's initial bill to take in consideration what's happening around the nation, a 12-year period. And in this case here, I think people want to say that we've been honest and faithful, and though another group may oppose it, we do have the opportunity to test ourselves, see how far we go with this kind of amendment, see if it flies in the House. If it does, wonderful. And then the Senate will have to evaluate just a little stronger. You know, how serious are we giving a true option to the people from what they want? Then you always have the conference committee. Luckily, this is moving very well now, and we do have plenty of time before 96. So I'd honestly would like to try this.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's been mentioned here that this constitutional amendment would not go into effect until, well, it would not be in effect, and this here would be make it retroactive. And I still keep going back to, well, where are the voters on this? They're still effective in their decision of, you know, who's going to come back or not. But I'm not going to vote for this amendment here, but I will on the floor of the House. Speaking of political.
We can all learn something from her. Any other comments? Should we go ahead and take the vote?
Representative Grusendorf?
No.
Representative Kelly?
No.
Representative Corey?
No.
Representative Martin?
Yes.
Representative Mulder?
No.
Representative Navarre?
Yes.
Representative Parnell?
Yes.
Representative Terrio?
Pass.
Representative Graham?
Yes.
Representative Foster?
I'll pass.
Representative Hanley?
No.
Representative Terrio?
No.
Representative Foster?
No.
4A, 7A.
Number 3 has failed. I'm sure it will be back on the floor.
Mr. Chairman, the one thing that is attractive about this is that Representative Brown would be precluded from running before I would, so I could experience a Representative Brown-free legislature.
As long as other people go down with me.
Representative Foster, did you have some comments on the actual resolution now that...
On the bill itself?
Yeah, we're through.
Well, you know, I'm against the bill. I feel strongly that, in listening to the amendments, I understand the sincerity of the sponsor of this legislation, also the various people here, and I kind of wonder if I'm the only one that's against this bill itself. But, you know, I feel that the... let's take Anchorage, for example, and we're looking at it from a... the tactics of the legislature and the numbers of the people that come from Anchorage. Anchorage has 42% of the population right now. I assume they've got 42% of the House. And so that would give them 16 or 17 members of the House right now. And if you pull in Greater Anchorage, some people out of Palmer or Wasilla, you've got a majority in this House, and you always will be in both bodies. And so no matter what the rural areas do, if you added up southeast and northwest and the north and the Aleutians, if you added up every other part of Alaska, you still wouldn't be able to have any attention paid to the rural areas unless you have the seniority system. And so I am against this bill. I feel it's like an Anchorage bill. And, you know, most things here boil down to the urban areas versus the rural areas, and I think this is one of those type of bills.
Mr. Chairman, and I realize and I'm sensitive to that argument, and that's why in just thinking about the concept, I didn't have a serve your time and you're out forever or serve your time and you're out for 4 years. It's just 2 years. And in discussion with the representative earlier, he said, well, the 2 years is not too bad because it's a speed bump in somebody's career. It's not a brick wall. So, you know, somewhere along that line in the 12 years, you'd sit out two, and then you get 12 more. So a person could serve 24 of 26 years.
Representative Kelly, then Foster, Grusendorf, and Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to associate myself with Representative Foster's remarks. I don't like the concept of term limits either. To me, it is a statement of saying, stop me before I vote again. And the people have term limits. They have the ability to vote people in or out of office. And what Representative Foster said, I think, is the most important, is there are, on the national level, disadvantages. We have, finally, our representative in Washington, D.C., finally in a position of power. It never would have happened with term limits. And I think if you look regionally, that the positions of power that people achieve in this body and the other body, it comes through seniority. And whether you compare it with Anchorage versus the Bush or Fairbanks versus Anchorage or not, it could also be compared with the executive branch. The executive branch comes into office with a certain amount of power incumbent in the position. So for the people to be adequately represented in the other two bodies, they need all the advantages that they can get to match the power that exists there in the executive branch, and that comes through experience. I was fairly impressed the other day, being a newcomer, watching Senator Halford and Senator Duncan duke it out there on the floor regarding the passage of the different boards and commission members. And that came from experience. And this representative beside me here, I'm very impressed with her amendments and what she does representing the minority. And that comes from experience, and that comes from being here a long time. And if the people want to keep sending people back for a long time so that they gain that experience and so they gain that power that they can match against other regions of the state or that they can match against the executive branch, then they should have that right. And I think we're being caught up in a little bit of a term limit frenzy. And people may say they want it from a vote, but in fact it is a constitutional right. And even though people want something, we can't always just discard the constitutional rights that exist because the people are crying for it. I think that we're making a big decision, not just in obviously in the Finance Committee, but we're going to make a big decision on that floor. It isn't just term limits. It isn't just saying we'll give the people term limits so they'll vote for us for longer. We're talking about people's constitutional rights, and I think we should take it very seriously, and we should forget political considerations, and we should forget necessarily what is popular at this moment, but stick to what we know is right and wrong. And I think it is what our system is based on, one man, one woman, one vote. And this, in some way, diminishes that. So I'm against the whole process of term limits, and that's essentially it for me.
Representative Foster?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I still could quite vigorously support this bill if there's some way we could exempt the rural areas from it.
Aren't the statutes sprinkled with...
Representative Grusdorf?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The last time we discussed this issue, I remained silent and kind of listened very carefully to what was being said and kind of kept asking myself, why are we doing this? I mean, who is this really for? Because we've already established that there's a tremendous turnover in the House and in the Senate. It appears that the voters out there are being selective in their thought process of who is best serving them and pretty well take care of the process. I guess those people that have stayed around for a while evidently has met that market test by their constituency and they keep sending them back. So it boiled down to, well, who are we doing this for? Will the public think any better of us if we do it? Probably not. Maybe for a day or two they would say we got term limits and then all of a sudden become disappointed because the person they wanted to vote for is no longer eligible for office. You know, it's just one of those things that kind of bother me because this is going to affect me one way or the other. I've never had any real desire to serve in the Senate in the first place and always thought that I'd best be serving in the House of Representatives. And maybe my district is different than some of yours. If you trace back the history of my district, you'll find that everybody who has served in the House or in the legislative body probably was the mayor of Sitka or the city and borough, which the people there kind of encourage you and tool you along through the process. And once they decide to get rid of you out of town to serve in Juneau, they want you to serve there until you either burn out or you just can't take it anymore. And so it's different. Some of you have been elected from your districts with qualifications that would never pass in my district. You have to have years on the assembly. All the candidates that have run against me, serious candidates, were either ex-mayors or assembly people that had differences of opinion. And Mr. Chairman, I'm kind of encouraged here that there's other people that are thinking the same way, that why should we deny the public, who is the ultimate judge, the right to determine who would best represent their interest? Now, maybe next time around they'll feel that I'm not best representing their interest. Maybe they think I'm too old or too conservative, too liberal, whatever it happens to be, but that's a decision that they will make. And believe me, just looking in this room here, normally your finance room has more experienced members in the first place in the bodies. But just looking in here, I see two people that have come into office by defeating a sitting incumbent. And I think that says a lot for our system, and that's the way I prefer it to be.
Martin. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things that people get concerned about all the time is the sacredness, the holiness of the Constitution. And I think they may go overboard that the Constitution is nothing more than a contract of the people with those who they elect to govern them. It's nothing super sacred. It's good that America started this principle of a constitutional contract, whereas you had the king and the dictators and all in the past. But it is not something that cannot be changed as the experiences of the people direct. And it's what meant by the people, by our framers, Jefferson, Madison, whoever, that it will be a flexible thing that will allow the people through their experience to adjust it according to the needs of the time. In this case here, this Constitution is going to be amendment, is going to be up to the people. Do we want term limitations? The Constitution belongs to all the people. It is a statewide document, not just for one district. And people will take into consideration your point of view from Matsu and your point of view from Sitka, and your people will consider those. Do we want to always have the right to elect our own people? Same way from the gentleman from Nome. His people may follow him. We want Richard. We want Richard. No limitations. So they'll probably vote against the amendment. But it is a thing that can be brought up and should be brought up at this time, or you never end it. But we don't have the public initiative. It's one of the few states that denies its people from changing its own contract. It's ridiculous, but from what the concept was. Anchorage versus the Royal Community. Well, if there's any an area in the state that is really not cohesive, one district is quite a bit different from the other, it's Alaska. And my chances of getting elected and represented Brown's district is probably zero. zero plus. Whereas in South Anchorage, you can almost take any body that's a Republican, and you can take a chimpanzee and put an arm on it, it's going to be elected. You know, just the makeup of an...
Not to insult
didn't mean you.
Anyway,
it shows you what the difference is. The same way they say with some royal communities, anyone that's a Democrat has a chance to get elected. So let the Democrats fight it out in those areas. In Anchorage, you have Republican districts, you have Democrat districts, you have districts that are really waffling back and forth, and it's wonderful. So the diversity in Anchorage, to me, is a real part of a democracy. And so I don't think you had to fear as much about the group from Anchorage sticking together as a team. No way in the world is that true. In the royal communities, you guys have proven the team effect much more effectively. So I really think that your fear of a large city against a royal community is not there at all.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At best, I'm lukewarm toward this proposition, and it draws a question in my mind as well with the comments made by Representative Grusendorf about who and what is driving the push and the urgency for the need of this concept. You know, term limits, in my mind, aren't a new concept at all. They certainly were around at the time that we framed our Constitution. And it makes you wonder why the framers of our Constitution didn't include it. Because certainly as you look around at other bodies, governing bodies that were formed around that point in time, there were limits put upon the amount of time that they could serve. 2 terms, 4 terms, whatever. But it wasn't included in our Constitution. And I think it was probably there for a good reason. But the framers, in my mind, if I were to conjecture back why they didn't include it, I would think it's probably because they didn't want to limit the range of choices. That they didn't want to narrow the scope of who the people could choose. Because that's what we're doing with this legislation. So we're limiting who these people can choose. And when you get down to it, I'm trying to evaluate today why we're in a sudden rush to push a limitation on. You know, it's been expressed that the people want this. Well, what I think the people want, when I interpret what's happened in the last few years, I think what people are frustrated about, as been expressed through term limits, isn't necessarily the mandate for term limits. What they're frustrated with is the loss of contact between the legislator and the population. When a senator or a representative gets too distant from his population, from the people they represent, they get frustrated. They get angry because they feel their voice doesn't matter anymore. Now, is term limits going to change that? Probably not. People are going to be people. Legislators are going to represent in the way they feel comfortable. Sometimes that's going to please the people, sometimes it's not. If it doesn't please them, they have the opportunity. This last election, I had great, I mean, my faith in the Alaska public was greatly enhanced because they took a voice. They stood up and said, we want people who are closer to us. We want people who talk to us, who are willing to get out there and shake our hands. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm not wild about this concept. I understand the need by the majority or the desire by the majority, but I find it very difficult to support it.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In my mind, it's a close call and a double-edged sword, and there, I guess I don't view it as, you know, a right or a wrong, because as Representative Mulder pointed out, we have term limits in the executive branch and the local governing bodies and in other contexts. So the question is, does it make sense in this one? And it does change the balance of power between the legislative and the executive branch. And I don't view that as a particularly positive thing. However, I generally, over the years, have felt that a term limit would be an improvement. And my reason for that is observing the accumulation of power that longtime members have. And I think that's really the thing in my mind that makes it worth doing or makes it come out slightly in favor of having a term limit. When you look at the entire system that we have of campaign financing, the heavy weight that incumbents have in this process. And, you know, we can talk about why people come back and their constituents like what they do and on. My instinct tells me that there is a great deal of advantage in incumbency and that the system is so heavily weighted in favor of incumbents that people may be returned to office whether or not they're truly serving the people. And I realize, you know, that it's hard to generalize. There's many different situations and specifics and all that. But in general, I would like to see the process be more open. I would like to see more turnover in the opportunities for people to serve in public office. Looking around this table, I'm the only woman. I would like to see a lot more women be in the legislature. I think that opportunities coming available in some regular fashion will benefit underrepresented groups like women and minorities. And for those reasons, I'm going to support this.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to support it because I think that it takes off the table, if it passes, one of the things that's viewed as a fix for the legislative process. And maybe after this is done, and I don't think it'll work, I mean, I think it will pass if the legislature puts it before the public, but it's not going to fix the problem with government, and I hope that it won't lead to even more apathy among voters, because now they can say, well, it doesn't matter whether I like them or not, they're going to win anyway, so I won't even vote this time, I'll just wait until 2 years from now or 4 years from now or whatever, and he'll be gone or she'll be gone anyway. We already have enough apathy. I think that one of the problems we have in government is that our responsibility many times is driven by the public's desire, which is really, truly uninformed. And by that I mean that those of us in the legislature know that the information that we have to digest and attempt to make a decision based upon volumes and volumes above what the public has to base their opinions on. And oftentimes we're led by the desires of the public, which are not always, in fact, most of the time I would submit, are not as informed as us. And I've seen too many times where people have made decisions based on, even if they didn't agree with them, because they felt that was what the public wanted. And I guess my feeling has always been that our form of government was set up as a representative form of government, and that the people elect me to make the best decisions possible in their in their interests, and my job is to try to digest and assimilate all the information that I have before me and make a decision that I consider in the public interest. And that's the way that I try to make my decisions. In this case, I think that term limits in Alaska are not necessarily needed, but it might take away one of the perceptions that the public has about the process. And if it serves to do that, then it's useful.
Just a quick wrap up. I think we have to keep in mind that what we're doing here is we're placing a question before the people. The same people that we applaud for being reasonable and informed in electing me to office. And so they're, I can't turn around and say that they're not informed and they're not reasonable in considering this question. I think we have to keep in mind this does not enact term limits. The people of the state of Alaska will or will not enact term limits.
Representative Corey?
I'd like to move for unanimous consent on this particular piece of legislation, HGR 5, as amended with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
You're asking to move it out with individual recommendations?
Yes, sir.
With unanimous consent?
Well, I don't think we're going to have it, but...
Why'd you ask for it?
Well, hopefully someone will change their mind here.
Are there objections to moving out the bill with individual recommendations? They're hearing none. The bill's moved from committee with individual recommendations.
All right.
Okay, let's move on to House Bill 120, Representative Porter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate very much your scheduling this bill to be heard. HB 120, Indemnification of Public Employees, is a bill that passed the House last year, found its way into that infamous black hole in the other side called the Rules Committee, and somehow didn't make its way out, along with several others. The bill has been around for some time. Basically, what it does is put into statute, for reasons that I will try to explain, what is basically policy virtually everywhere in the state, including state government. What it does is indemnify public employees who are acting within the scope of their employment from normal acts and or omissions during their course of employment, from a civil suit, tort suit, and protects them so that they can, number one, feel that they're a little bit protected in trying to do a good job within the mission of their employment, and also provide them the security that, as often happens, individuals, especially those in management positions, find themselves named in civil suits just because of their position in a line of authority. And so doing that, that name on a civil suit gets into a record in the court system, and when people check those records to make decisions on credit, there pops up that name, and the credit concern asks, well, what is your protection? And many employees in the state now can only say, well, it's the policy of the state or the policy of the municipality that I'm protected. Unfortunately, the other side of that is that policy can be changed next week. Statute, obviously, is a lot firmer position, and consequently, people have had bad credit ratings because of their names being in that position in a line of authority in a civil suit, when in actuality they were fully protected by policy. You'll notice that the bill precludes the requirement for a government to protect an employee against punitive damages, which would preclude the requirement for protecting a person who has committed gross negligence or an intentional act that is reckless. It doesn't preclude a state or a local government from doing that if they so choose, and as a matter of fact, some do now. But it didn't seem to be appropriate public policy to put that into effect. The fact is that most represented employees receive these protections now through labor contracts. The bill precludes school district employees, University of Alaska employees, REAA employees. It doesn't, we're not trying to take them out of this protection. It's, they're excluded in here because they already received this protection in another statute. What this would do is to bring everyone into the protection that most people have right now. I'd be very happy to answer questions. There are people here from the AG's office and the State Department of Risk Management who could answer specific questions in those areas if you have them.
Mr. Chairman? I represent Mulder, then Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Porter, questions come up during the Corrections Subcommittee about probation officers and correctional officers. Would this also indemnify them?
That those particular employees are one of the groups of employees within the state that are not now covered by either labor contract or within the other protections of education people. Yes, they are particularly vulnerable to suit from inmates.
Exactly.
And I assume, I'll have to admit to a personal bias in this, I just got my name off the last municipality of Anchorage suit about a year and a half ago, and I've been out of that position for 7 years, so they are in the same kind of position okay. Would benefit from this.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman, Representative Porter. As we had talked in the subcommittee about introducing a specific piece that dealt with that, appears as if this will cover it. Is that your reading also, Representative Brown?
Okay. Representative Brown, did you have a comment or a question?
Yes, I had a couple questions. If he's done.
Are you done?
Yes, I am.
Yes,
thank you. I have two basic questions. One is, who's covered by this bill? And specifically, are legislators covered and legislative employees? And I asked our drafter that, and she thought that it was somewhat unclear. And working with her, I drafted this amendment that's been distributed. Do you have a copy of it?
I've seen a copy of it, and I have no problem with the amendment.
And what led me to think about that was a couple of years ago, the members of the Finance Committee were individually named for having failed to appropriate, I believe it was a labor contract. Do you remember that one? And I'm not sure of the disposition of it, and I was wondering, are we, the legislature, as elected officials, covered somewhere else by something else? I mean, I know we have the immunity in the Constitution from suit during session, but...
I was under the impression that all public employees not so covered would be covered under this bill. If you want to set it out specifically as you have, I have no problem with it. Really.
Okay. Thank you. My other question goes to the policy we'd be establishing by saying to the – now, think about this from the viewpoint of the injured third party. Okay, if the state's a little bit – if the employee that harmed you or whose action led to your harm or your damages was just a little bit negligent, the state will cover that. If the employee was grossly negligent, the state won't cover that. So the person who is the most damaged and the most in need of getting their situation righted is left without compensation. So I'm wondering about the implications of that, and I presume that's a trade-off there between just trying to limit the liability of the state, or how do you view that issue?
Well, I view it as a permissive and not required. I don't think it's good public policy to say that the state will provide total protection to someone who commits gross negligence or intentional wrongful acts. That would be the wrong message to send to your employees, that just go do whatever you want, we'll cover you. Correspondingly, though, a person who, as a public employee, runs off and does that, the victim of that act or omission, one has the ability to sue that individual individually and recover whatever he or she took from that individual's assets. Secondly, the state is not precluded by this legislation from providing additional coverage, and I would think probably would consider that based on a case-by-case analysis of just how gross was this. Sometimes actions could fall into a gross negligence consideration where reasonable people would see that although this was gross in this particular case, probably this employee didn't have that frame of mind when they were acting, and so the state could provide that coverage. But I don't think it's good public policy to say that they will cover.
And if we, could I continue? If we were to cover it or decide to cover it case by case, how would that occur? By the AG in individual settlements or through labor contracts? Or when you say it's optional and it
all
might happen,
above.
How would it happen? All of the above? Mm-hmm. In this memo of February 3rd that Teresa Kramer wrote, there's a sentence that says, the employer is also excused from defending or indemnifying when the case involves a disciplinary, administrative, or criminal matter brought against the employee, or when the employee has been convicted of a criminal offense or terminated from employment because of the conduct. And I was just wondering, does that mean that the employer is excused if it involves a disciplinary matter? So, I don't like what this person's doing. There's some degree of negligence there. It may have been only slight, but I'm feeling as the supervisor I should take some disciplinary action. I'm disciplining this person because they didn't follow the procedures or whatever. Am I then out from under the requirements of this bill?
I believe it, and perhaps the AG's office would be a better place to confirm what I'm about to say, and I'll ask that they do that. But it's my understanding that what that means is that the state would not be required to provide the unless it's already provided for by labor contract, provide the indemnification for the defense in a case that they brought against that employee. In other words, if I want to fire you and you don't like it, I will pay for your defense to dispute my termination of you. That doesn't make a lot of sense. What if that act, though, led to a civil suit, it would fall back under the provisions of this bill if a third party.
Well, that's what I was wondering, if the state could get out of its obligations to indemnify a third party by just saying, hey, it's a disciplinary matter.
No, I don't believe that's the case.
Representative Porter, if we could, I'd like to. We have a couple people on teleconference, and a couple people like to testify, and I want to make sure we get to them since they're on teleconference. I don't mind.
The other thing, Mr. Chairman, that I just wanted to understand was, you know, we've had several of these suits and indemnity cases come up in the supplemental bill, and I don't know. Are you familiar with Greenfield, with the Greenfield v. State?
Well, I'll ask Susan Cox to explain that more completely, but. I just became aware of it this morning, and it's my understanding that that case involved a constructive termination allegation. The employee at API quit, but her allegation was that she was forced to quit, and the state or the court apparently agreed with that and awarded punitive damages. If the court awards punitive damages, This bill wouldn't affect that one way or the other in terms of protections. It wouldn't require the state, as we've discussed, to indemnify against punitive damages. The state could if they so choose.
But in general, would some of these claims that we're seeing come before us not be possible because if this bill were in effect?
No. Any case that now can be brought after the passage of this bill can also be brought. The only thing this would provide is a statutory guarantee in simple negligent cases that the state or a municipal entity would protect their employee by defense and by indemnification against damages. In cases where the allegation is gross negligence or intentional act, the state or the municipality or borough is not required but may by their own policy.
If we could, I'd like to go to the teleconference so we can get some of the folks that have been online. Mr. Otis, are you there?
Yes, I am.
If you could go ahead and identify yourself. You're with the Peace Officers Association and you're in Haines, is that correct?
That is correct.
If you could go ahead with your testimony, please.
Well, the Alaska Peace Officers Association strongly supports this bill. And in fact, in 92, it was one of our five priority issues. And we've been behind this bill for a long time, believe that the state needs this bill, and in 92 we wrote a position paper on that. And the position paper will take about a minute to read, if I would have your permission to read it.
Go right ahead.
Okay, we believe that government must be held responsible for its actions. When someone is wrongly harmed through the actions of government, injured parties should be able to make claims as appropriate. However, we believe very strongly that government employees should be defended and protected when their actions are made in good faith. Generally, when a lawsuit is filed, employees are listed as parties to the action. In the past, employees have not been held personally liable for actions taken at the behest of their employer unless they were clearly working outside the scope of their authority. This seems to be changing. Recent court rulings imposing personal punitive damages are placing the livelihoods of our public employees in jeopardy. The trend where public employees are being held personally liable places employees in a position where their own personal assets are at risk. All government employees are in danger, from the highest level policymaker to the lowest level of workers where those policies are carried out. The social worker, the road maintenance supervisor, the police officer, the medic, the firefighter, the department manager, and elected officials are all vulnerable. We in law enforcement believe this is an undue burden upon the state's public employees. It carries great potential for the workings of government to become bogged down because employees fear that decisions they make in good faith may result in the loss of their assets. When employees are doing the work of the government within the scope of their authority and without malice, they should not be held personally liable when they are named as parties to lawsuits. Legislation should be passed that indemnifies public employees and frees them from the burden of working under the constant threat that the good faith judgments they make can result in the loss of their homes or their savings.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rose. If we could, if you have a fax available, and maybe you could fax that statement to us, we'll make sure it gets to the sponsor and included in people's packets. Our fax number is 465-2278.
I'll do that.
Thank you very much. And thank you for testifying.
Thank you.
And we also have Mary Hughes on from Anchorage, I believe. Mary, are you there?
Representative Hanley, can you hear me?
Yes, if you could give your name and affiliation for the record, please, and go ahead.
Thank you. With me is also Deputy Chief Dwayne Udlin of the Anchorage Police Department.
Thank you.
So the Deputy Chief may want to give some testimony after I'm through. I feel like I am Mary Hughes. I'm a municipal attorney, and good morning to the chairman and the various committee members. I feel like a poor substitute this morning since Scott Brand Erickson has been working on the bill and has chosen this week to go on vacation. And so, unfortunately, and I apologize to the committee, you get me. The municipality of Anchorage supports the bill. It's in our official legislative package that has been designated as a package of activities that both the mayor and the assembly choose to send to our legislative body. I think it's important to note, and I think we pointed this out in a letter to Representative Porter's office, that the municipality of Anchorage, in effect, today utilizes the same type of policy. And in effect, if this law were passed, it would not affect our policy. It would only make things very much clearer for employees. For instance, just the other day, I had a situation in which I wrote indemnification letters to several members of a board, which was being made individually. The various people were being the deputy chief may have better statistics, but since I have been here, and that has been approximately a six-week time since the first of the year, I've had occasion to indemnify probably around from 10 to 12 people. So that's a pretty, it's kind of unbelievable within such a short time. And so maybe we've had a raft of lawsuits in that period of time, but certainly the municipality utilizes the guidelines and set forth in the legislation and doesn't have any problems with those guidelines. If they were state law, obviously things would be a little bit clearer from the employee standpoint, and perhaps the employee would feel safer in going forth and participating as he or she does in his or her public duties. So we are very supportive of the legislation, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions that the committee or members have.
Thank you, Mary. Any questions of Mary at this point? Thank you. Did Mr. Udlin, did you want to testify?
Yes, I would, just real quickly. I've testified on this bill in the past when it's been in this legislature, and I'm happy to say that it's passed the House, it's passed, but hope it does again. The LAFT Association Chief of Police, whom I represent, has made this a priority in the legislation for about 6 years now. And for all the reasons that were stated in the, by the EQA officer there, paper,
you, Mr. Edlin. We also have Mr. Ludwig. Would you like to testify here in the audience? And then Mr. Ritchie as well wanted to testify if we could.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Ludwig, and I'm the business manager for the Alaska Public Employees Association, Alaska Federation of Teachers, and the secretary treasurer for the Alaska State AFL-CIO. We're strongly in support of Representative Porter's bill, but we'd like to echo two concerns that Representative Brown raised. And one is an 010B3 talking about the termination of if an employee is terminated. And the concern we would have would be that an employer may think that they could somehow get out of the liability if they would terminate an employee, when ultimately, when it was all decided in the end, if the termination was incorrect, they'd not only have to pay the attorney fees and the back pay, we just think it would create a lot more problems in the long run if it's left in there, that there might be actions taken which might not otherwise be taken. And again, on the punitive damages part, the key to the whole bill is that an employee has to act within the course and scope of their employment, and that's the filter by which you judge whether or not it's something's covered. If that results, if a jury determines that if they acted in the scope of their employment, but they did so intentionally, you know, maybe somebody else told them that something was okay and they intended to do the act, and they were found, punitive damages were found against them, the employer ought to pick that up. If they acted within the scope and course of their employment, all their acts and consequences should be covered. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ludwig. Any questions, Representative Brown?
So do you have any specific recommendations for the language involving the termination or disciplinary action? Are you saying this should or shouldn't be in here? Or?
Should not. What I'd suggest is in 010B3 is just strike all after criminal offense. So it's scratch or terminated from employment by the public employer. And in 010D, I'd suggest just deleting it. I know in our contracts with the state, we specifically do include punitive damages. But like I said earlier, the primary filter is whether somebody's acting within the scope and course of their employment.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ludwig. Mr. Ritchie?
Hi, my name is Kevin Ritchie, the director of the Alaska Municipal League. Municipal League is in support of this bill. This is a mandate, but there are mandates that are good and appropriate, and this one would likely save money and save consternation, especially on the part of small communities. This is a type of advice that you might get from an attorney in a small community after some amount of money had been spent and potentially after some damaging situations has occurred. So we see this as a very positive bill. And personally, having experienced this situation both as an employer and a few times as an employee, I feel that it's a balanced bill and is good advice for both the employer and the employee. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Yes, Ms. Cox. That's fine.
Mr. Chair, my name is Susan Cox. I'm an Assistant Attorney General for the State of Alaska. And if I may, I'd like to respond to a few of the questions that have been raised by the committee so that everyone's clear on exactly what the bill would do. With respect to Representative Brown's question about the defense of legislators or legislative employees, the state currently does provide the defense of the legislative branch when personal injuries occur in the course and scope of that the legislative employee's business. We've had car accidents, we've had plenty of other cases. It is certainly possible, I suppose, for someone to make the argument in the definitional section that public employer, when it says it means the state, that somehow the state is only the executive branch. I think that would be an unfair interpretation of the statute, but certainly the amendment to specify that it includes all three branches of state government is not objectionable. with respect to exclusion of gross negligence from the coverage, Representative Porter pointed out, I think, fairly that that we don't want to have a blank check here to encourage public employees not to be careful and cautious, and we don't want to have any kind of incentive to or or disincentive to avoid, shall we say, gross negligence. It is true that anyone, a third party injured by the gross negligence of a public employee, can sue the public employee directly. And in fact, an allegation of gross negligence in the complaint will not deny the employee of defense. The bill specifically states that the public employer may not base solely on an allegation of gross negligence or intentional or willful misconduct in the complaint withhold defense. So what you will see is a situation where the employee may be sued, most likely the employer as well. The plaintiff may contend in the complaint that gross negligence occurred or that there's an entitlement to punitive damages from the employee. Certainly most cases do end up settling, and the employer ends up settling the whole thing, all claims against both the employee and the employer, and you don't get to the determination ultimately by a jury that gross negligence was involved. There would be certainly no incentive for a public employer to argue that its employee's actions were grossly negligent. That certainly wouldn't help the employer any, and in most cases they would be defending the employee on the merits, contending that either there was immunity or that there was no negligence committed by the employee at all. So I think, as Representative Porter pointed out, this is a fair balance. The language regarding an exclusion of coverage for gross negligence and intentional willful misconduct is actually taken from existing collective bargaining agreements. It's something that is excluded, at least in some agreements. I'm not personally familiar with the APEA agreement that Mr. Ludwig referred to, but it is also common in most of the collective bargaining agreements not to indemnify for punitive damages. And in fact, I believe there is only one situation in which that has been negotiated with an employee union with the state of Alaska. The major concern that I've heard, at least it's come up a couple times here, is with respect to 010B3, the provision that defense or indemnification would not be required where someone has been terminated from employment by the public employer. And the question is whether that would provide some incentive to the employer to terminate an employee. I think the answer to that question is no, for the simple reason that the employer is vicariously liable for the actions of the employee. And so merely terminating an employee to avoid having to defend and indemnify them is not really going to do the employer a whole lot of good if they are responsible for the employee's actions anyway. So I don't see this as providing a great incentive to the employer. In addition, of course, most public employees are covered by collective bargaining agreements and subject to termination only for cause, which is a very high standard, something that is subject to post-termination grievance and arbitration provisions. So I don't see this as providing much incentive for an employer just to try to duck an obligation to defend or indemnify. I think chances are, in most cases, what will happen is the employer would defend because the employer would also be a party, most likely, to an action, and only upon conclusion of grievance and arbitration provisions, if the employee was truly terminated for good cause, then the employer could avoid having to pay a judgment against the employee. But if the employer is also vicariously liable for the actions of the employee, that is not necessarily going to save the employer a lot of money. If, however, the employee was grossly negligent or committed intentional misconduct, then, of course, the employer would not be paying. An example that we could look at is a shooting incident where a law enforcement official has shot someone, perhaps killed them, and the determination is ultimately made that that was grossly negligent or even intentional misconduct, a corrupt official, perhaps. The employer is not going to be responsible, ultimately, for indemnifying that employee if they were legitimately terminated because of their actions.
On that point?
Representative Brown.
Thank you. Well, you keep talking about indemnify the employee, and I keep thinking about the third party out there. So let's say that example you just gave, they terminated the officer, and now is the state at that point, or the local government, responsible to indemnify the damaged parties, the family or whoever?
That would be a question of law that is independent of this bill. This bill only addresses whether we will have to pick up the tab for the employee. Whether the employer is liable to the injured third party will be a question of law. If we are only liable through the actions of the employee, then the answer is no. It will depend on whether the injured third party has a claim against the employer that they can make stick.
Although I just look at the language at page 1, line 10, and pay settlements and judgments.
Yes, and those are entered against a public employee. This is an obligation of the employer to pay judgments against the employee. That's what this bill is about.
So it wouldn't affect judgments against the state itself? Or?
No. No, in fact, there is a provision that is at least tangentially related on the second page in F, line 24, that says whether or not we defend or indemnify an employee does not constitute a waiver, a limitation, or expansion of the state's immunity or other types of immunity. So it doesn't. It makes the point that this bill doesn't change anyone's rights in terms of suing the state, whether the state's going to be immune or not immune if we're picking up, if we are defending the employees. So this bill does not affect the public employer's liability to third parties. It does not alter the third party's right to sue the employer and recover from the employer. The only other thing I think I'd like to address, certainly in B2 on the second page, starting at line 6, there is an exception for paying the defense or indemnification of an employee related to a disciplinary, administrative, or criminal action. That would be a matter in which the employee is involved in a disciplinary matter or an administrative.